I think your eyes just want more clarity.
Every time you watch a movie, what you're actually watching is 24 individual still frames in every second of footage. But right now there is a cabal of high-powered Hollywood filmmakers, the likes of James Cameron and Peter Jackson, that want to change that. And this week on Download This Show, the Oscar-winning director behind movies like Brokeback Mountain, Life of Pi, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, yes, Ang Lee, talking about why he wants to change this basic rule of movie making after all these years.
So far, the audience reactions kind of everywhere. From resisting to embracing.
Plus, the battle for female eyeballs. This month, the Nine Network have launched their new female-focused family of sites, Nine Honey, with style, fitness, food, and parenting content. News Corp have launched their women's site. So the question is, why now, and will they succeed? Let's find out. This is your guide to the week in technology, the media, and culture. My name is Mark Fennell, and welcome to Download This Show. And it is a big welcome to our panelists this week, and very exciting. We have two new people who have not only never done the show before, we've also recently discovered they've never done radio before, so this is going to be exciting. We have the editor of Mashable Australia, Jericho Mandibur. Welcome to Download This Show.
Thank you.
It's lovely to have you here. And alongside Jericho, we have the head of data strategy for the agency MNC Saatchi, Lucy Atchison. Welcome to radio. Welcome to Download This Show. Don't look so terrified.
Good morning.
Good morning. All right. So if you want to join in the conversation on Twitter, you can. The hashtag is Download This Show. You can also head along to the Facebook page as well if you have topics that you want us to cover. And we're going to start with women, specifically women spelt with a W-H-I-M and an N, which is actually how they spell it at News women. Corporation at the moment. There's been an interesting development this year where we've seen a number of very female-focused content networks launch. We've had News Corp launch Women, which is spelt, and I'm not joking here, it's spelt, how is it spelt, Jericho?
W-H-I-M-N.
Which stands for?
With her in mind.
Right. There's also Channel 9 have launched a series of female-focused verticals called Nine Honey, which is led by Helen McCabe, who some people will know as the former editor of the Australian Women's Weekly. And, of course, one cannot forget the juggernaut that is Mia Friedman's Mamma Mia Network, which has plans to expand significantly in 2017. Now, women are 50% of the market, but it does seem like right now there's a real moment for this kind of content. And I'm trying to work out, why is it that these major media organizations have decided to focus so heavily on capturing the women's markets at the end of 2016?
It is absolutely fascinating. And as you say, I think it's brilliant that media are reacting to new audiences and providing great content for, as you say, 50% of the population. I don't necessarily think, though, that it's a reflection of gender equality necessarily.
Would it be money by any chance?
I think it's all to do with eyeballs,
right,
essentially, and defining a new audience and trying to get better engagement with greater relevance through them creating content for pink content for women, essentially.
Is it really called pink content in Adland? Is that what they really call it?
I've just created
You've
that.
Coined that.
I just made that up. That's great.
I've always thought that pink content, like, because you hear the term pink dollars, it's associated with the gay market.
Well, let's
you guys
just
can fight it out. It's fine. I don't want to get in between you guys.
Let's just call this yes, female directed content.
Okay.
But as you say, I think it's to do with dollars.
Yeah, I totally agree with Lucy. They're really just probably trying to fill a commercial gap in their offering. Mm. If you've got, you know, a new platform that's dedicated to women, you've got more ad space, you've got more sponsored content opportunities. Mamma Mia has probably done that the most successfully, but that was really because it was so person-centered and it kind of had this organic growth and quite a loyal following. And I feel that these other players now are trying to kind of emulate that.
That's really interesting because, you know, Mamma Mia's had a long run-up, right? It's taken a long time to grow. We're talking about companies that are stepping in with a big investment, often some quite big names, Helen McCabe in the case of Nine. What are the challenges facing a large company trying to step into this space and own it quite quickly?
Mamma Mia seems to be very authentic and have really rich, deep and newly created content specifically created for that audience. Whereas it felt like, and I could be completely wrong, so apologies if this isn't true, but Nine Honey was taking content that already exists and just giving it a bit of a female spin, which felt like they were jumping on the bandwagon kind of with one foot, and sort of doing it slightly half-heartedly, relying on the famous the celebrities as their draw. And I think that one of the challenges they'll face, as you say, is that Mamma Mia has been running for so long because they've been trying to capture as much data as they can possibly capture on their viewers, so that they are now in such a powerful position because they've got all this data, all this insight, which actually now they can use to create even more and more relevant content for their audience. Whereas some of the new entrants to market won't have any of that data and insight and intelligence as to creating that relevant content, and so will struggle because of that. They won't be able to be as relevant because they don't have the data insights.
It's really interesting what you're saying about repurposing content in the case of Nine Honey, because one of the first things the editor of News Corp's women, they thought their real advantage moving forward was they were going to create original content all the time, which I think was a bit of a dig at the Nine Honey scenario. So I want to break these different organisations down for a second here. We don't know a great deal about what Women will be because it hasn't launched yet. They've announced. But Nine Honey is up and running, and what it is, Nine Honey is a overarching brand within it that has a number of different verticals or websites. So there's Nine Elsewhere, which is for travel. There's Nine Style and a variety of them.
If you go to the nine.com.au website, you have the kind of the topic verticals at the top. Fashion, fitness, things that might be more as traditionally seen as women's interests. And then you also have Nine Honey at the top. If you click on Nine Honey, you have the same content options that were on the original homepage, fashion, fitness, what have you. So it's kind of a double up. So I think the reason that it exists is, because they're trying to create this like destination for women where they can be really engaged. But the content offering doesn't actually seem to distinguish itself in any way other than the fact that it's on a different kind of URL.
Would you actively choose to go to Nine Honey?
I don't know how many people in this day and age actively choose to go to websites anymore, like unless it is maybe something that...
It's always great when a website editor comes on the show and says that.
It's true, you know, like people engage with news through social.
You both mentioned something at the beginning of the show that I wanted to come back to, which is it was driven by money, which is obvious on one level, we get that. But there is a whole universe of people that want to advertise that really are looking to benefit from a women-centric platforms. Can you talk more about that, Lucy? Who is looking to advertise and where is the money here?
So from my understanding, Mamma Mia have recently bought their own data management platform. I don't know if you're familiar with what DMPs...
Do not. Explain to us.
Okay. So a data management platform, the way that I would explain it to my mum is that a data management platform...
I'm glad that I remind you of your mum. This is good. I don't know what I've done, but it works.
Is a black box in which you can store information, cookies, visits, all sorts of behavioral data about an individual. And generally that data comes from the web. We at the agency call it third-party data. And it's the DMP is a box which takes third-party data from all sorts of different publishers and sources, glues it all together and tries to make sense and tries to identify people, audiences, cohorts, whatever you might like to call people. And then you can use that information to profile who your customers are. If you feed your customer data into the DMP as well, you can say, here's Lucy. Let's take Woolies for an example. Yep. Here's Lucy. We know she's a young family. She does A, B, and C that we can see from our own data. But actually, I want to know what Lucy does on the web. And the DMP stitches those two pieces of data together and allows you, A, to target Lucy. Mm-hmm. With relevant content, or B, to find lookalikes that look exactly like Lucy. So Mamma Mia has poured all their data into the data management platform, and they have taken all of the behavioral site data and have now created, as I understand, 10 personas, 10 different types of women, mums. I don't know the details of the personas, but 10 discrete segments that they're able then to sell onto publishers and brands like Woolies, who go and say, I want all young mums, find me them and allow me to advertise just to them on the site.
In your time in advertising, how much has the understanding of data changed your business?
Oh, it's absolutely massive. It's huge. I sometimes pinch myself. I've come from a below-the-line direct marketing background from the UK. You can probably tell I'm from England.
Oh, you're from the UK? No, I didn't pick up on that.
Yeah, I'm from England, where direct and data has been going for the last 30, 40 years. Mm. But in this market, I think that data-driven strategies from an advertising perspective has only really started to change in the last 3 or 4, 5 years. I don't think necessarily, and I could be wrong, that I as head of data would have had a role in a traditional above-the-line agency 4 or 5 years ago, certainly in this market. There's been a paradigm shift in the use of data for advertising.
Is there additional value in launching niche subservices in the sense that they attract a very specific audience that can be monetized at a different rate? I guess I'm trying to understand why big broad media companies, your News Corps and your Nine Networks, what's the value for them in launching targeted, unique spaces for demographics, in this case being women?
I think as Jericho alluded to earlier, this is about potentially decrease in engagement and a decrease in eyeballs generally over the last 25 years from a news and a media perspective. And I think I'm speaking out of school, and I hope no one comments negatively about what I'm about to say, but in terms of eyeballs are going down, especially within certain demographics, and I don't know if it's true, but females and younger audiences, millennials who are engaging in lots of other things other than traditional news networks, they've realized this, and that the first logical step is to swing towards the niche and to become more segmented, more targeted, and to build that niche audience in the hope of attracting the eyeballs back to them. I mean, it's just something that we do in advertising and have been doing in advertising for, 40, 50 years in terms of identifying an audience and just creating relevant content for that audience. But it just seems that the media guys are just jumping onto that bandwagon more recently.
Jericho, I want your opinion on the decision by Nine Honey to brand everything Nine, insert other word here. Does it help make it feel like a cohesive whole, or does it feel a little bit conglomerate to you?
It feels a bit conglomerate. It looks funny. It looks like a typo. It's kind of just, I don't know, maybe it's because I'm not a really long-term reader of the Nine Network, but it just seems like a typo, like someone's just put Nine at the front of this thing. It doesn't feel super personal. Mm. And
does it feel confected? Because I was thinking about this the other day, like the websites, and I'm obviously in a certain demographic, the websites that I tend to go visit, Junkie or In The Mix or things in that space. Now, that's all one big conglomerate. That's Junkie Media, and they have all these different brands within them, but they each feel organic. Does bringing them all together under a Nine headline, does it sort of diminish that sense of it being a unique and authentic place?
Yeah, I think it does, because someone who's interested in TV news and recaps of Game of Thrones has really not much to do with someone who's interested in motherhood. Like, they could be the same person, but they could be vastly different audiences, and to kind of just plop them all together like that, it feels slightly forced. And the name Honey, like as an umbrella platform, is a bit, I don't know, I've heard some talk on social media about that.
Yes.
Got some work to do branding-wise, and obviously naming your platform with her in mind is similarly interesting.
Just send them to M&C Saatchi, that's fine. We'll sort out the branding issues for them. No, I agree with Jericho. I thought the Honey was very saccharine and, yes, too pink.
Something icky.
Too pink, yeah.
If you were completely to rebrand Honey, and I'm really putting you on the spot now.
Bear in mind, I'm a data specialist.
I know you're a data specialist. I know you're a data specialist. But as a consumer, maybe, what are the sorts of things you would look to shift about that brand? I assume Helen's listening now. If so, hi, Helen.
As Jericho said, I think that branding everything with the Nine in front just smacks of sort of corporatize, if that's such a word.
It's
corporatization.
Now. It is now.
Let's make
You've
up
said
a
it
new
on the
word.
National broadcaster. It's
there
a word.
There we go.
Now.
There we go.
What if the strategy for Nine Honey is just SEO? It's just, being the first thing that pops up in Google searches. What if their strategy is less about social, less about being a homepage, and more about being the first thing that comes up when Google hits? It wouldn't necessarily harm them if that was their strategy, would it?
No, completely. I mean, no strategy is a bad strategy if it's your strategy.
I sense you've maybe said that before in meetings.
No, it's true, because I don't know what their objectives are. I don't know what their KPIs, their measurement is for how they're going to be successful over this year, next year, the next 5 years. So without their insight, I wouldn't like to comment on their strategy. But yeah, if that's what they're trying to do, it's purely an SEO grabbing eyeballs exercise, then play in that space. But as I said, seeing how enormous and how fundamental websites like Mumsnet are in the UK, I'd be aiming for the A game with a great deal more substance to it. And as I say, that community feel.
There are great kind of case studies of different female-focused websites that exist overseas that we don't really have in Australia. I'm thinking of things like Jezebel, which is a sort of a great opinionated female-focused news site that I think came out of Gawker Media. Mm-hmm. Are there lessons that you can see overseas for what's maybe missing in the local market maybe?
Yeah, I think that Jezebel is a really good lesson for the local market, and also sites that are even more kind of niche, like Reductress, which is kind of like The Onion for women's content.
The best podcast ever. If you're going to listen to a podcast after this one, obviously listen to something from RN, but then when you're done, listen to the Reductress podcast. It's the strangest, most wonderful thing. I can't recommend it enough. Carry on.
Yeah, it's bizarre, and it's just something that, you know, it fits the internet so perfectly, and it actually really values the intelligence of women. It's really tongue-in-cheek, and it's a real kind of in-joke. We don't really have that. Everything here is like a lot more simplistic and, yeah, pink.
Very pink. When we talk about female-focused services and websites, and we talk about advertisers associated with that, there is a sort of an unconscious bias, I think, in commentary to jump to, well, it's great for health and beauty brands, it's great for Unilever, it's great for grocery buying brands. But there are other brands that aren't traditionally associated with this space that seem to have demonstrated a high interest in it, and one of those being car brands and things like Car Advice. Why are those sorts of organizations looking to find an access point to this particular market? What's the value for them there?
85% of women actually have some influence in terms of the car buying decision and the car buying journey. And I think it's an old, outdated stereotype piece of insight to actually suggest that it's just blokes who rock up to the forecourt and they lay down their dollars and off they go. They drive away the new wheels.
Not my experience of buying a car at all. My wife went that one.
I want that one in that colour. Exactly. Yeah. So look, I don't think that they're any different to anybody else. They're recognising the dollar starts within a household, and that nowadays massive purchases like a car are actually 50-50, or as I say, if not more biased towards a female, actually not necessarily paying for it, which makes me sound terribly sexist, but money coming out of the bloke's bank account, but the woman actually making the decision. So again, it's all about eyeballs and dollars.
Download This Show is what you are listening to. It is your guide to the week in technology, the media and culture. You are listening to the voices of the head of data strategy for MNC Saatchi, Lucy Atchison, and the editor of Mashable Australia, Jericho Mandibert. Mark Fennell is my name. Now, he is the Oscar-winning director behind Life of Pi, Brokeback Mountain, and countless other films. He's also joining a chorus of filmmakers who want to make a drastic technological change to how movies are made. Now, traditionally, when you make a movie, what you're actually watching is 24 individual frames per second. But then, a couple of years ago, a film came out called The Hobbit. The Hobbit introduced the idea of 60 frames a second. Now, they claimed when they made it that it would remove strobing and flickering from action scenes, but a lot of people watched it and actually found it quite difficult to watch. They found it too clear. They found it a little bit video looking, a little bit like sort of a soap opera, which is shot on video, and video is a high frame rate. Now, the Oscar-winning director Ang Lee wants to push it to 120 frames a second, higher resolution, and in 3D. But why? Why is what I want to know. Does it really add anything to the story of his new film, Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk, which is out this week, and it tells the story of a young Iraq War veteran dealing with PTSD. And a little bit earlier, I spoke to Ang Lee from Taiwan to find out exactly why he wants to change the way we make movies. So why 120 frames per second? What are we getting that we don't get at 24 frames?
Strobe free. We live with strobe since day one of movie making. Flickers. So once you pass like 90 or 100, you begin to see a clear picture, very much like life. I think 60 start to look pretty good, but it still feel like movie. But I decide to go a step forward, which is strobe free. that's 120. I think your eyes just want more clarity.
Just to take, say, The Hobbit as a recent sort of very public example of a high frame rate, a lot of people complained about it. They said it didn't feel familiar, it didn't feel like a movie. Can you train the audience to see the value in high frame rate filmmaking?
They will be challenged. Indeed, they will be challenged. It's less safe for them, so to speak. The challenge is that with clarity, it comes to, can you still dream with clarity? How do you invest your emotion into it? It's going to be a transition time, I think. So far, the audience reactions kind of everywhere, from resisting to embracing. I think the way you engage, the audience engage with the cinema, that relationship sort of changed. So it can be more first person kind of expression. Anything new is challenging, ranking from exciting to strange. Anything could happen. So it's a new happening. I'm just anxious to know how it goes.
And so for you, directing with 3D, high frame rate, how does it change the way you work with the camera? Is it more complicated?
A lot more, because you lose your confidence because there's no reference. In the meantime, your actors know their marks, know their lines. You still have to perform. For me, the scary part is, first, it has to be more accurate. From lighting to performance to art departments to camera movement, even to focus pulling is challenging. I found other than I have to give direct actors with specific direction, I have to also keep them alive, like on screen. That's a big job. So they cannot just do performance. They have to be alive, which is more complicated, like in life. I think that challenge I'm quite welcome. We shot quite slowly. The most scary part actually is there's no reference. You don't know how people take that. There's no previous example and nobody can teach you. I can only try my best, so is everybody. But because of that, I felt the investment, particularly emotionally, is quite real, quite genuine, because everybody has to give their best. That's quite precious to me.
What would you do differently? If you went back and did Billy Lynn again with these particular technical constraints, what would you do differently?
I think technically we will be better. I think we also eventually we need better equipment, more sensitive camera, smaller body and everything. We need to upgrade a lot of things.
I'm curious what you think the future of movies are. Like, there's so much competition from television, from Netflix, from gaming, from social media. What do you think the future of the big screen is going to be? Is it going to be more immersive, more 3D, more high frame rate? Is this what movies are going to look like in the next 5-10 years?
I think so. At least that's one of the options to draw audience into the theater, which is getting harder and harder. You know, people have been watching movies on iPhones. How do you get them into the theater? It's not only telling a story or take emotional ride or thought provoking. I think it can be more of an experience.
How do you feel about movies being watched on mobile phones, out of curiosity? Are you comfortable with Ang Lee films being watched like that?
Well, let them do it. I would like to make something for the bigger theater, so they will come to the theater. I think we need theaters. We need a group activity. It's like a ritual to me. I think we need that kind of gathering. We need to have the ultra experience, theatrical experience in a big black venue. I think that's necessary. Then after that, you can stream down to television, to your computer, to iPhones, however people want to do it. But for me, the most important thing is there's always a big theater that attract people get into there. Theatrical activities, it's very important for us. It's spiritual.
You have quite a strong track record of tackling new filmmaking technology with each of your movies. I mean, Life of Pi, phenomenal example, some groundbreaking techniques in there. Why? Where does that interest lie for you?
Well, personally, I'm not a technical person, but I just like to see things in a fresh way. It's a sight and sound experience. How you see them, how you experience that is very important. I think new technology, new media, new way of showing provoke us to keep our freshness when we deal with materials. I like the challenge.
Ang Lee, thanks so much for talking to us. Appreciate your time.
All right. Thank you.
Ang Lee, they're talking about his new film, Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk, which is out in Australia very soon. But actually, interestingly, they don't have the cinema capacity to actually show it in 120 frames. So even though we had that long conversation about why he wants to change the way movies are made, you will not necessarily be able to see it that way, which I don't necessarily know is a bad thing, to be honest with you. I do think the film's quite good. Welcome back to our panelists this week. We've got Lucy Atchison from M&C Saatchi and Jericho Mandiber, who is the editor of Mashable Australia. Do you think a high frame rate adds or subtracts something from the visual experience of a movie?
When I saw The Hobbit, I was totally unaware that it had a different frame rate. So I kind of just thought, this looks a bit funny. It seems kind of flat. A lot of light, and I couldn't quite put my finger on it. And it was only afterwards that I kind of realized that that was the difference. It was pretty distracting, but I think that, you know, like I can see people coming around to it. I don't necessarily think it's going to remain as distracting as it is now forever. But yeah, it's a bit like a choose your own adventure. You can't quite focus. You're really not being led through the story in the way that you typically are.
That is so true. I didn't know where to. And actually, it's funny, in Billy Lynn, the film that Ang Lee's done, I think the film's quite good, but I didn't ever really know where to look. And you realize how much of the way traditional film focuses your attention on a face, or, you know, it directs your eye to a certain point. The visual language of that hasn't changed, but the fact that everything is completely sharp, it adds a sort of an artifice level to it. Your experience, you've got kids that watch The Hobbit on a loop, as far as I can tell. What's your opinion of high frame rates?
Well, as Jericho said, I had no idea what the new technology was, but I actually loved it in the cinema. Incredibly crisp, enormously sharp. As you said, couldn't put my finger on it. I think it worked for me. It works very, very well in that fantasy, fiction, completely bizarre. I mean, you're looking at goblins and hobbits and, you know, trees that walk, right? I think it actually works.
And I think it definitely has the capacity to add something. Having a level of kind of, like, on one hand, there's a real emotional immersion because everything's so crisp, but there's a real heightened artifice as well. And that almost seems like it's kind of thematically relevant. Add something interesting to the film that wouldn't be there otherwise. Yeah. So I can see people doing kind of interesting things with it. And I think eventually it'll just maybe become the norm. But yeah, right now it seems like directors are more ambitious than cinemas can actually handle.
No, I agree with you. Anything new is different and uncomfortable for a while. It depends on how new and how different as to how long it feels strange. But as you said, I believe that people who know their craft should be pushing the boundaries of that craft and making us think outside and feel outside of our comfort zone sometimes. Otherwise, we will still be watching black and white Charlie Chaplin movies.
And that, ladies and gentlemen, is all we have time for on the show today. Very big thank you to Lucy Atchison, the head of data strategy at M&C Saatchi. Thanks for being on the show.
My pleasure.
We didn't terrify you too much with this whole radio palaver.
It was wonderful.
You did great. And Jericho Mandiber, the editor of Mashable Australia, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Now, you have come to the end of this program, which means you're probably looking for another thing to listen to. Can I recommend The Science Show from RN this week? They've got a great program about how social media can change democracy, how you think about the news. It's a really phenomenal program. Head along to the RN website right now and you can download it. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is all we have time for. If you are listening to this on a podcast, make sure you rate and review us. It's a really critical way in which people can actually find the show, and we appreciate it. I get a big, nice, warm, fuzzy feeling every time I see a nice rating come through on iTunes. I really do. A weird affectation of mine. And with that, I leave you. Thank you so much for listening to another episode of Download This Show.